regular and supplemental meetings are called to order. We'll recess the supplemental meeting. First, can we have a moment of silence for those in the system and their families who aren't with us anymore? Thank you. We can move to the minutes from the February 13th meeting. Do we have any comments or questions on those? If not, can we have a motion to approve?
A motion to approve.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Public? Anyone in the public like to say something?
On the phone, press 5-star.
We promise to treat you better than we were treated yesterday. All right. Okay, next we move to item C1, legislative update. We have the people from Hilco on the phone. Kelly or Josh, any of you want to kind of tee it up? Or?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Yeah, I'll start. So, since our last board meeting, there have been a number of bills filed. Obviously, the big one that you got a copy of was the Senate Bill 1527, filed by Senator West, trying to amend the plan essentially or really exactly like the city had previously proposed and passed in their at the council. So we have online Buddy Jones, Eddie Solis, and Mark Clark from Hilco Partners. They're going to kind of give you an update on the session, and they can talk about a little bit about the Senate Bill 1527. There's a number of other bills that were filed that I'll go over after we have the discussion about the session about Senator West's bill. I guess initially I'll let sort of Nick and Kelly give their thoughts on Senator West on the hearing yesterday that was in the Senate Finance Committee. And then the Hilco folks can give their views on that and give maybe a few views on the session as well. And then I'll come back around and talk about the other bills that you got emailed this morning that propose amendments to our plan. So I guess with that, I guess Nick and
Kelly. Yeah. So yesterday was just a disaster in my perspective. This 1527, spearheaded by Senator West, was discussed, and you know I heard some information from them that was incomplete, out of context, without any perspective, and then I think in the normal course we would have a reasonable way to dispute or probe. And at best, that was you know, a very limited time to speak. The points that we were making didn't seem to sort of resonate or land with anyone. And you know, my main point was that why would you approve the superior bill when you have a superior bill that has stood the test of time and has a mechanism to achieve all the things that we need to achieve to make the system sound? And that the part of the bill that allows the city to get sort of re-involved in governance here, to me, sows the seeds of problems down the road that caused the big mess that we had to deal with. So that whole line seemed to sort of fall on deaf ears. What I heard from the people is that their view is that we, staff, us, are to blame for all the problems that ever happened. Why haven't we fixed them? Implying we're not competent and things like that. And how dare we approve a plan going forward that has anything that's labeled a COLA in any way, shape, or form. So the two things that they constantly went back to was the funded ratio and the COLA, and in sort of a typical thing where talking and not a whole lot of listening. We tried to make some points with limited time, so we got asked some detailed questions that, you know, who am I to say what's relevant to something in the eyes of someone who's in the legislature, but to me they weren't the pertinent things. Like, for instance, what's the cost basis on investments that we made, you know, back in 2000, 2005, 2010? I mean, we inherited them on a written down value, and we maximize value with those. And not that that is a stupid question, definitely not, but it wasn't, to me, a priority question. The priority questions should have been more, I would say, more about what we've done specifically, what we inherited, and what's our plan going forward. So it was just incredibly disappointing. And, you know, part of it, and, you know, when Hill goes on, I would like to have a better understanding of why we didn't understand that we were going into this incredibly one-sided adversarial environment where I don't really think anything that was said would have made a difference, but that's just my own conjecture. So, Kelly, what do you think?
The only thing I would add is,
can we go back to understanding the whole purpose and the procedure and what exactly was going on, like, and how it came about?
So, it was the hearing of the Senate
side
on the 1527.
Okay.
So, Wes got to lay his bill out, and then there was supposed to be testimony on each side.
Okay.
Nick and I signed up for testimony, but we're not allowed to testify. Basically, they kind of pretended that they thought we were resource witnesses, so we weren't even allowed our 2 minutes. It was, we could kind of answer questions, but not really, not plan on them. I mean, we couldn't explain anything. I plan on talking about why the funding level declined, the fact that we knew in 17 it was going to decline because the city's contributions weren't covering the ADC. Those were the projections in 17. We talked about it every year. The cities had that information every year. That was if all assumptions were met. We didn't get to talk about that. Clearly, they had been talking about that, and there were comments from a couple of them that, you know, clearly we failed because we're not now 70% funded, when we knew we were 45% funded in 17 and it was going to go down. So somehow it's a big surprise we're not at 70.
The last meeting, because of the relatively high number based on the agenda that legislature had with, you know, Abbott's priorities, how did it get so escalate? I mean, how did it get expedited without us really having advance warning that it was moving so quickly?
That's a good question. Maybe the guys from Hilco could weigh in on that.
Yeah, I think, yeah, they can definitely address sort of the process of how bills, once they're filed, get move along in committee. Really.
I mean, as it was moving along, why weren't we better prepared by our consultants to, you know, have the conversations that needed to happen to make sure the information was disseminated properly? So it feels like we were blindsided.
Yeah, I'll let Hilco.
I'm also curious of the author and the motives and who he's representing. I mean, I just need to understand that relationship a little bit more as well.
What relationship?
West and the city of Dallas.
He's got a relationship with the city of Dallas, and he's always represented.
Yeah, that's right.
Why?
I'm just
kind of curious. I mean, because if he's coming at this with just one-sidedness, and if he has the influence as he does, then our approach is going to have to be, I mean, what are our options?
We'll hear from Joe.
So, Buddy, Eddie, Mark, you guys want to kind of pick up on 1527, and then you can spend a couple minutes talking about the session in general.
Sure, I'll start off. This is Buddy Jones. I have been doing this about 46 years, and this is not an unusual thing. It sometimes happens when a member gets a burr under his saddle, and he is back in the back room, and he convinces a chairman that we need to get a bill out of this to send a message. And that's part of the dynamics of the legislature. Let me also say, Mr. Chairman, I thought you and Kelly did a great job under very trying circumstances. And no one lost their cool, and we stayed on message, but they weren't interested in the facts. Today, legislators just really believe they know more what's best for the cities around the state than city government does, or that our pension plan government does. And so this was one of those examples. Let me also say, Mr. Chairman and members and guests, this was the first series of downs in the first quarter. And even though it was not a good series of downs for us, we got a lot of game left to play. There's two branches of the legislature, and when one branch does something in a very public way like this, the other branch goes, well, wait a minute, we're going to take the opposite in many, many instances. So I don't want us to panic. We got to be on our game. But there's no need to panic. We've got lots of time, lots of room left. And so we are going to do what we can to make sure that it gets a lot better and from here on in. Now, I do think this bill will pass the Senate. I think the vote yesterday was such that I had three members say, buddy, I'm against the bill, but it was just it was a tidal wave, and I wasn't going to go against it. So that's part of this game. I say game is part of the process, and while it's not pretty and it's not fun, we're not finished.
Buddy, this is Michael Technique. I just want to look. I know the pension's had a long relationship with OCO and everything, and So I don't want this to come off as insulting or negative in a way. My frustration is that going into this, we need to know what we're walking into. And it didn't appear we knew that yesterday. And clearly, like you said, they didn't use correct facts. They didn't use correct numbers. They asked questions and then said, well, I don't really need an answer to that. They had an agenda going in. Going forward, we just need to know what we're walking into.
That's a fair statement, and I wish we had known all of it too. We're pretty good at what we do, and we were disappointed as well as you were, sir. And so we got to do better.
Hey guys, Tony, can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, we can hear you, Tony.
Quick question, buddy. In terms of the next step, what's the possible success ratio or likelihood of us putting together position papers and interacting more with Senator West and his staff to help educate them as to, you know, what the real facts are versus his interpretation of the facts? Or is that a zero-sum game?
Eddie, I'm sorry.
Well, we continue to, as Buddy mentioned, this is Eddie Solis. Thank you for having us on, and certainly disappointed as all others. We have had long and lengthy discussions over the interim and coming into the session about the dialogue that was going on between the city and the system, and what was being concluded because of the actions required from the 2017 legislation. The members of the committee, the Pension Review Board, on both sides of the House and Senate, have been being informed by just HILCO or in addition to the meetings that we've had with Kelly and Josh with these groups along the way to help them keep up to speed with what was going on and where the differences were. As the process goes forward, we continue to inform the members and make sure that we reestablish or reiterate or reinforce the points we've been making all along as to the responsible nature and responsible plan that the board adopted. And so we continue to do that. We've been doing that over the interim. They were not listening to facts, but they had been presented with facts. And we just respectfully continue to inform the members and their staff of where the differences are between the dialogue and reiterate the facts that we've laid out as to the value of the plan that the board adopted as responsible to the 2017 legislation.
So I have a question regarding just the process. So when the bill was filed, what kind of conversations were started at that point to kind of seed the conversation? Because my understanding was with the number of the bill that, you know, it was not necessarily likely to get out this session with everything else that was on the agenda. And so I'm just curious in terms of your process, what kind of conversations were ongoing long before yesterday?
Well, they were certainly ongoing before the bill filing, because it was, in essence, or in reality, the plan that the city had submitted to the PRB. And so the dialogue that had been going on during the interim was to draw that comparison between the plan that the system submitted in November and the plan that the city submitted, whenever that might have been, September or August, I can't remember exactly when. So those discussions had been going on. That bill was essentially a proposal to codify the proposal that the city had made. So as far as what was in that bill, there wasn't anything necessarily surprising or unaware of those provisions, but it was evident that Senator West worked very diligently to have the chair hear that bill as early as they did, which was yesterday.
I guess my question is, why wasn't HILCO working as hard to educate the legislatures on the correct facts and the information so they were either better prepared or more knowledgeable with the bill and the ramifications to the constituents?
Eddie and Buddy, can I say something about that?
Sure.
Please.
Hey, this is Mark Clark. Just going to the question that you're asking, going directly to it about preparedness, and Eddie went over pre-session and during the session in anticipation of what the issues that were going to be that would be against the interest of the pension board. We had been in contact with Senator Huffman's office talking about this issue and didn't receive an unfavorable response in the sense that she had made her mind up over what her position was on it. We were told directly by our chief of staff that it was going to have this hearing on this bill to let both sides speak their piece. Obviously,
as recent as 3 days ago.
Yes. And when the hearing started, Senator West was given a very unusually long and protracted opportunity to lay out the bill and frame everything from the perspective that he wanted to frame it. And during that period, the chairman of the committee, Senator Huffman, immediately was basically chiming in support, very, very, very much so in support. And then that's when it started taking on a life of its own. Now, going backwards a little bit, we worked the committee prior to the hearing, where we went around and visited with every individual member and Kelly and Josh were there, and while it wasn't, we weren't receiving a lot of love, we didn't receive what we thought were negative feedback from people. In fact, had some people tell us they were no's on the bill. So the hearing takes off. It's, as the chairman has explained to everyone very well, it got off to a bad start and didn't get any better. And it was emotional testimony. It was anger from some of the members on there. There was one senator we expected a problem from who his perspective on pensions, number one, and then his view of himself on investment weighed in. He said a lot of things that were not true, not factual. In an environment like that, the chairman of your fund nor the lobbyist involved can jump up and challenge him in the meeting. So that just went on. And what ended up happening, I think the chairman of your fund there explained to you, Nick said, that really the center that he identified what the center of their anger was over everything that had been done and was the COLA. And that seemed to be the linchpin for their anger and emotional direction that they took on this thing that I don't know if I would say it was surprising, but it just got out of control at that point in the hearing. Now, to give you a further example about it, the bill in 2017 laid out a process that y'all followed to the letter. And the chair of the committee even vocally, while laughing, said in the hearing that nobody should ever use that actuary again. And surprisingly, the PRB people are sitting there in the audience, and they're the ones that recommended these people. Y'all didn't. And so that's to give you the tone of how we did our pre-meeting rounds. We didn't receive negative feedback. We felt like we had done our job as far as doing the pre-education of members, but Senator West was given an unusual period of time to tell the story the way he wanted to tell it. The chair of the committee, who's very powerful, was upset about the COLA, upset about the funding level, and chimed in and started driving the train. And now going back to Buddy's point, that was just a hearing in the Senate, and yeah, it was a little bit early and probably going to come out of the Senate, but the fight isn't over. And, you know, what we'll do is what we've always done. We'll work the members. We'll go to them. We know what was said in the Senate committee. I think with y'all's help, with contacts that you have, we've already been working a Dallas delegation in the House. So that's what we do, and that's what we're going to continue to do, and we're not going to give up.
When do you see the second reading of the bill?
Well, it'll go. They'll send it. It goes through a process in the Senate when it leaves the committee, and then it'll be probably in a week or two
Maybe the lieutenant governor would recognize.
The lieutenant governor would, and he may slow it down a little bit, but the lieutenant governor would recognize Senator West to bring the bill up. And we anticipate that we'll talk to members, of course, but we anticipate that with everything that happened and he's already walking around working the floor on the Senate. And also you need to know those, believe it or not, these legislators do trade things off with each other. So I think our focus, as Buddy said and Eddie has said, is not to give up there, understanding what the reality probably is, but doing a full court press in the House. And on that, I think time will be on our side because there's some other really major issues going on in the legislature that have people's attention, and usually those kind of things like that can bottle matters up for a while.
Well said, Mark.
So guys, I guess to sort of bring this, you get the essence, speaking to Hilco now, you get the essence of where we're coming from, which is that you guys, as a key business partner and advisor, we have an expectation that it's not just output on your side, but not just input on your side, but there would be output as well. So, you know, how many meetings you had and all those things, that's great, but ultimately we're looking for insight and advocacy,
hey guys,
from you guys And in the in sort of the episode of yesterday, if we did not have Delco and we just went in there blind, you know, we would have lost 13-0. I think that's my recollection of the vote. And with you, we lost 13-0. So we acknowledge the and you guys, we believe you to be very competent, and you know, on both an individual and sort of an institutional level. And I want to send you a clear message, which is that we hear you, that this is only part of it, but that I want you to hear us, that we expect more. We expect a more value-added set of deliverables from you as we go through this. And that is our expectation, and I don't think anyone would tell us it's unreasonable, although probably those people we met with yesterday would tell us it's unreasonable because we think it's reasonable. So that's where we're coming from, and we need you guys to deliver for us, but we also need a real clear honesty that if we are dealing from weak hands and low probabilities and things like that, you need to tell us. You need to tell us, you know, as soon as possible. And like a lot of things, we're not super interested in how much time you spend because we know that's part of it. What we're interested in is your insights and the results that you can deliver on our behalf. Does anyone have anything they want to add to that?
It seems like maybe, I don't know Dallas politics, but it seems like there's an undercurrent of conversations or actions going on.
In context of that committee, there clearly was. I mean, I've never been a state senator, and I don't know a whole lot about it, but it, you know, it was sort of the thing where Senator West, in the confines of that, controlled almost everything from my perspective, and, you know, or he was his ability to exert maximum influence on the spot was very self-evident. And, you know, it was not that we did anything humiliating, but it was a humiliation for us. That's the way I look at it. But I do acknowledge that it's, you know, we're only partway through this. And ultimately, we think we know what's best to do, and we know what our job is. And, you know, the main thing about this legislation that they have is they want to reinstitute part of the things that led to the problems in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is just so objectionable from, you know, kind of my 7-8 years of being involved here and in engaging with the city. I don't know who speaks for the city. You know, I think the bill says this is the city council. You know, how would that work? They would vote on something. How long would that take? Who would we talk to? What if we hear one thing from one person, another from one thing? What if they don't respond? You know, and they say, well, we can't agree to that. Let's say, you know, go back to I can't name it because we're under confidentiality. Remember the litigation from a couple years ago? We received significant proceeds. Okay, that was minute by minute, hour by hour. Type negotiations that yielded a very, you know, good number for us. Okay, let's say we had to get city council approval for that. How quickly would we get that city council approval? You know, I just think through the practical realities of this, and it just to me is just it's like an intra-city tariff we were imputing on the pension in terms of doing our job, and it reintroduces, once again, I'm assuming that I'm looking at myself and all the people here, we're all replaced. It's a new set of people, okay? And you just think of that part of what has worked for us is that I think it's a high-quality group of people, especially staff, but more is that we have a good set of rules that we operate under, okay? We're good people in a good system, okay? But emphasis on this being a good system. This bill sows, I'm not saying it instantly becomes a bad system, but it
it introduces the seeds of what could turn into a bad system in X number of years. And everything we're talking about are 30-year type things here in terms of the dollars and the funding amounts and all that. So from my standpoint, and, you know, everyone knows that, you know, I'm most likely only have a few months, and then I'm out of here. I really feel an obligation to fight as hard as possible to preserve the system. And I mean that not just system in terms of the specific noun of the, but the system of checks and balances and how decisions get made and the deep political nature of it. That's where I'm coming from. And so, you know, we want to kind of move on here. Hilco, I think you've heard us loud and clear that you know, we view this as, you know, something we expect more from you guys. And more is not just input, it's really from the output standpoint. And we're going to fight hard to preserve this system and not have it contaminated by what I think could be the effect of 1527.
Mm-hmm. So I just have one other comment. So from what I'm hearing, that we can just forget the Senate. that we could just forget it. Okay, so it's just going to be like good money after bad situation. So right now we're looking at the House. What we do hear from that hearing is what their arguments are, okay, and how they're going to come after us for the assumption rate and our funding. So in doing that, are we positioning and are we framing the arguments or discussions with House reps?
Yes, and we're going to begin. And
okay.
We want to move on, but yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all part of the discussion.
But in the sense of planning and what they're
we know what our, in the eyes of the senators, we know what the flashpoints of vulnerability were, and we need to better address those. So that is, if there's anything good that came of it, throwing three interceptions in the first quarter, you see where your vulnerabilities are, and so we will respond accordingly. So.
And I also believe that it needs to be plainly, too, because
we all met earlier on some additional analysis and more. It's not really an additional analysis, it's clarity of analysis that we want to show that helps refute some of the points we heard yesterday.
Okay. And that's also helpful for the board to know that.
But
as
one
well.
Of the biggest things Hilco can do is that, like, those people didn't even act like 3358 exists or 3158 existed. I mean, the premise was such a lack of knowledge of a bill that they had passed. That was one of the big shocks to me. And Senator West was able to use that lack of knowledge to imply that that we were the ones that made the bad investments. Why are we still here? You know, I don't know if you all listened. I went in and I spoke, you know, that was one of my first points I made, that I want you to know is that they have our full support. And I said, I'll be happy to tell you why if you want to. That was something, you know, I didn't want to make it anything like that, but that was the one point I really felt compelled to make. So, Hilco, did you hear us?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, good. All right. Anything else, anyone? We'll stay tuned and all this stuff.
So there are a few more bills that we should talk about that affect our system. There's one other bill filed by Senator West. I'll deal with that one last because I think it requires a little bit of board direction. But there's four bills filed in the House by Representative Davis. One of them basically functionally allows. I'm so sorry.
Just a comment. they have a check TV now.
Well, you fix that. Fix that when you get over there.
Yeah.
You good, John?
Okay.
Did you guys hear that?
Yes.
It was for your entertainment.
We did a quick little dance. We're all sitting down now.
I was dancing in my living room. It was great.
So the first bill deals, there's three bills that deal with drop. One of them basically allows members to come in and take out, retirees come in and take out their money, essentially. But basically, if the bill were to pass September 1st, I think it's $900 million would go out of the fund within a week or something. Basically, it requires that the board not deny any hardship requests. So the second one, not quite as bad, but very bad, is that it would reinstitute interest on the drop accounts. The third bill, not quite sure we understand how it would work, but basically it required that the actuary sort of segregate drop from the rest of the plan in terms of taking into account for actuarial purposes. And it sort of is interesting because in some ways it goes back to the thing from the old days where people thought that drop was a separate part of the plan instead of the fact that the money is all together. So I didn't even know how they would even work that. We didn't even ask the actuaries. I think it would make their heads explode. But so those are the three bills that she filed on drop. She filed a fourth bill on the board makeup, which basically, although the numbers, when you look at the bill, the numbers don't really work because it talks about three trustees, but then it talks about four being appointed by members. So in essence, what she's trying to do is establish parity in the board. She wants four appointees from the city and four appointees from the members, although the bill says three, and then it then articulates four different places to be appointed. So I'm not quite sure what the bill is intending.
What it's doing is it's adding one more police position, one more fire position, and those would specifically be retirees.
Right.
And the others are active. It's taking those two positions from the city council.
But the bill talks about, the bill says, it's pretty much a typo, but the bill says three, and then it talks about four separate positions.
I think the three are the non.
No, I think it's, but anyway, regardless, that bill, all four bills, we don't believe will go anywhere, and we don't believe that they will even get a hearing in the House pension. So we're not focusing on those at the moment. The other bill that is, I don't know if it will get a hearing, but it's a bill filed by Senator West at the same time as 1527. This is 1529. It's a bill that got filed last session. It is intended to increase the amount of years that people can be in drop and get credit into the drop account from 10 years to 20 years. The actuary has run an analysis similar to what they did last session. They came to the same basic conclusion that it yields a very small increase in the liability of approximately $2 million. So right now, there's nothing to be done because there's no hearing set, and we haven't been asked. If we are asked, then Kelly would provide the committee the actual analysis, which they would ordinary course request. I think the only question that might arise if the bill does get set for the hearing is what's the pension system's position on the bill. I think that we believe, Kelly and I believe, that since the Chiron did not include that, any kind of changes like that in their report, that there's not really a good basis for the system to be in favor of the bill. But by the same token, the change in the liability is so minuscule, it's hard to see why the system should necessarily be against it. And so I think we think we should just be sort of neutral and let the legislature and the city figure out if it does come to pass, if it does come to a hearing. That's where we think that the system's position should be. So I don't know if there's any thoughts on that bill.
The bill, I'm a little confused, maybe. I think actuaries are mathematical magicians, so I don't understand the math where on the extending of drop,
It doesn't exactly increase liability. It doesn't increase debt. I don't understand how they come up with that, because what you're doing is you're taking away, these people are paying in money that they're eventually going to take out.
Right.
There's no increased liability, because that's still just that's extra money they paid in. So I don't understand how they're getting to a place where I understand how if they continue that drop, it basically goes into, you know, the little drop account. There is no increase in debt when they leave, because it's not zero. There's 0%.
It's not increasing. I mean, so
there's no debt added, so I don't understand how they say it's an increase.
But we're not paying out. I mean, right now there's people that have exceeded the 10 years.
Yes, and they're paying in.
Some of them haven't gotten any additions into their drop since 2018. They forfeited 7 years of pension payments. Forfeited, not made up for later. Mm-hmm. So that's money that isn't going out of the system.
Yeah.
The system. So we keep that money, and it helps with the future liability.
So the actuaries have assumed that 25% of the people who hit that 10-year limit will continue to stay employed.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, instead of having to have additional drop money be credited to their accounts, they won't be credited to their account. So that is viewed as a savings versus keeping it at a 10-year. So if you go to the 20-year, you have additional money being put into drop for the 10 years to 20 years for 25% of the people who hit the 10-year limit. And that, however the numbers work out, that liability ends up being greater than what you're talking about, the savings.
Unlike the old drop, that which was annuitized, in the new, they can get that as a lump sum?
No.
I'm not talking about. I'm not talking about from Fred. Like if you started drop like 5 years ago, and that wouldn't be a lump sum either.
No, you can't get any. So the reality is, the actuary does its analysis over a 30-year period. We're talking about $2 million out of a $5.3 billion liability.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the right number. It's going to be some other number. It could be positive. Could be slightly negative. But we have to go with kind of the actuarial assumption piece that we have. And that was their calculation, and it was consistent with their calculation last year or 2 years ago. So that's what we have. I just feel like also on that bill, we just need to focus on the bill that matters. And I think being neutral on the bill from the city side, they're calling it a retention bill, and it is a retention bill for the city. So they should be the ones to push it.
I don't have an argument against not being neutral. I'm just trying to the wording of it where, because this is a net plus for the way it is right now is a plus for the pension. If it doesn't exist, but going forward, it's not exactly a negative, because it's like if I hand you an apple every year for 10 years, and then I hand you an apple every year for 20 years, and then, you know, I don't take away apples. You just don't have the extra. If I can't do it for the extra 10 years, you just have 10 apples instead of having 20. I mean, that's
now I'm paying 75 people that I wasn't paying before, is how it really works out. And and next year it'll be 125 people or 102 people or something like that. So that's the difference.
Okay.
But we can sit down. I'm happy to have all of the experts sit down and go over it.
Yeah.
Because it's complicated. But
everyone good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Kelly, ministerial actions.
Yes.
Crazy.
Hilco, Buddy, Eddie, Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Keep working forward. Thank you.
Ministerial actions, there was nothing unusual for this month. Oh, there were 8 retirements, which is less than the last 2 years, so that's a good sign. Any questions? The next item is the contribution update. The city is still paying the contributions based on their plan versus what is now the law as affirmed by the court. So the running total that they're short for fiscal 2025 is $7,052,000. You add the 2024 promise of the $7.3 million, $14.3 million short so far. That's where we're going.
Bottom line is they still haven't paid. They said they paid $184 million in 2024, and they're still at $177.
Correct.
So when they go in front of the Senate and talk about everything they did, they still haven't even in the previous applications.
Right. So all the starting numbers that Chiron used. The next item is the trustee travel and education. I don't believe we've approved a lot of people to go to TechFirst at the last meeting. Is there any other people that want to be added to that or any changes on the education list anybody has?
Am I on the list? I think I should be.
You are on the list.
Okay, good.
You are one of the M's. Sitting next to the MAM. For the conference.
Yes.
All right. The next item, actually, we had board member report, but we don't need to do that item. So we can move right on to the trustee terms and draft election schedule. So I included in your material the discussion sheet that indicates to you which trustee terms are up that expire in August. I'm required to do that based on our election policy. And this only relates to the non-member trustees. So the three non-member trustees, Nancy, Tony, and Marcus, terms are all up in August. None of them are term limits, so you can all run again if you choose to do so. That would be awesome. So I've attached for you a proposed schedule for the election. The nominations committee can alter the schedule, but we've typically stuck pretty close to it. So in the next month, we will meet with the nominations committee. We'll lay out a schedule and a process for the election process. I assume it will match what we've done in the prior years. We will take applications for trustees April 23rd to May 14th, slating applications to be due May 14th. The nominations committee will review those applications. We'll try to do interviews sometime between May 19th and the 22nd, with an election starting June 16th. And we have the election that early. There has to be a runoff. We have time to do another election in July, if necessary, to make sure we've got all the trustees seated before their new terms begin in September. That is the plan. Any questions?
Who's on the nominations committee?
So the nominations committee is laid out in the statute. It was part of HB 3158, we know and love. And it is a representative from each of the named associations. There are more associations now than existed at that time, but they can't participate because they're not named in there. I always like to say, I don't know if you guys will appreciate this, but so the nominations committee are those, I think, 11 associations named in there, but police and fire usually travel alone, so it's 22 people.
Yeah.
I chair the committee, but I'm non-voting, so it's 22 people usually from each association, and we go through it. But they're actually very efficient because we've done this now several times. And then these.
Can I ask a question? Is there anything that we can do in terms of give a perspective, or should we just stay out of it in terms of? Love to see these people nominated or anything like that, or should we do we have an ability to weigh in, or are we prohibited from doing that, or what?
You're not prohibited. I hope the Marcus and Tony and Nancy will all want to rerun, and it will
sure.
be easier and great.
Okay. I would, yeah.
I mean, I'd like to.
And then I think
I'd like to express at least my perspective that I hope all three of you decide. I think all three of you can ask.
I think Tony has discussed
yeah.
that he wants to.
I definitely would like to, for sure.
Okay,
and so has Tony. So I think.
Yeah, I would, you know, if I'm welcomed, I would absolutely love to.
I think that committee would like to know that you guys are supporting.
Yeah, 100%. And I would like to see Nancy back also.
Yeah, we'll just have Marcus put your head down if anyone doesn't like him.
I want to know what his campaign promised before I sway my vote. What's your position?
Yeah.
Okay, so on that item, I do need a motion
okay.
to adopt.
To adopt the draft 2025 non-member election schedule subject to adjustment by the nominations committee, provided the first election is completed prior to July 2025. Board meeting and a subsequent election, if necessary, is completed prior to the August 2025 board meeting. Do we have a motion?
Motion.
Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, Ryan.
All
Right.
Okay, I just want to say one thing, Ryan, is I hope Dory Wiley or someone from there is listening, because where their critique of being not enough S&P weighted and we were more globally weighted,
mm-hmm.
I hope you comment on what's happened in the first part of this year. So maybe Commerce Street or some of the other people who enjoyed that report or advocated for it or whatever could weigh in and say, has their views changed? I'd be very curious about that.
Diversification, how about that?
Okay.
At the end
so
of
they
the
normally don't make it this long into the meeting.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll
all
have
right.
the slides on the website regardless. All right. So first thing I wanted to point out, Akshay Patel, who is an investment officer for us, left plan at the end of February. He got a really good opportunity at North Dakota Lands Trust.
Wait, who?
Akshay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was a surprise to us. So he left a couple weeks ago. Like I said, good opportunity in North Dakota to be an investment officer up there for the land trust. So we've had a chance to kind of get together, figure out what we want to do to replace that role. And we've posted for an investment operations analyst. So instead of hiring another investment officer, we want to get someone that can help take a lot of the operational burden off our plate a little bit, free up some investment time. But also, I think I'm thinking more of this role as a hybrid kind of operations analyst, more junior person that can come in and work on both the portfolio and the operational side of things.
Okay.
I miss him.
Is that easily found?
I'll let you know in a week. I've had like 7 calls this week and some good candidates I've talked to already. So I'm hopeful we'll find someone that's a good fit. All right, onto the portfolio. Year to date, the portfolio is up 2%, 2.8%.
Through when?
Through the end of February. And we have an update through March given the equity market going crazy the last few weeks. The 2.8% for the public portion through February, that's 80% of the portfolio now. Aaron will cover in more detail the 12/31 year end performance report, but we were up 7.9% for the overall portfolio. On private assets, we got $80 million back last year. We've gotten nothing material year-to-date this year. On new investment activities, on the private credit side, we are in the middle of a direct lending search. We met with the subcommittee at the end of February. We're down to kind of a few opportunities we're looking at. And the subcommittee, which is a subcommittee of the IAC, has a meeting scheduled in April to interview finalists, and then we expect to bring that recommendation up to the board probably in May. And then on the multi-asset credit, because remember in the public credit asset class structure, we carved out a 4% allocation target to multi-asset credit, and we're kind of initial stages of surveying the market and talking to some managers in that space. Expect to probably issue an RFP after the April 24th IAC meeting. We've got those two running in parallel. What's coming up next after that, similar to what we do on private credit, we'll have a private equity pacing plan coming to the IAC in April, and that coming back to the board in May. So kind of new private credit investment, and then we'll move on to some other spaces in private credit to look at, and then likely private equity coming right after that. Any questions there? All right, I'm going to turn it over to Kyle to kind of run through some of the market charts and all the context we're needed.
Thanks, Ryan. Good morning, everyone. So we wanted to include some information. These are updated from what went out last week on Diligent. As Ryan mentioned, those earlier returns are through the end of February, but much of the market rotation has taken place in the last couple of weeks in March. So this all goes through the end of day Tuesday. Right here, we're looking at kind of the sector rotation that's taken place. I think it's important to point out that 8 of 11 sectors have had a positive return year-to-date through 3/18, with most of the sell-off being concentrated within consumer discretionaries and information technology. I'd also point out that a lot of the names that have had very significant losses have been some of those most concentrated names in an index portfolio. I think, you know, this is a great illustration of why diversification is good, not just globally, but also across sectors.
And I would just say on the the two names of the Mag 7 that were the most underweight to are Tesla and NVIDIA, and those have been hit pretty hard year to date.
So as Ryan mentioned, we do have a public equity return through 318. DPFP is up 1.5% on our public equities, whereas the MSCI ACWI IMI is down 40 basis points, and the S&P 500 is down 3.8%. One of the things I want to call out here is the rotation between U.S. and international developed equities. International developed outperformed by 14.9%. year-to-date compared to the S&P 500. So we've seen a pretty significant move from this U.S. dominance towards international markets. A significant chunk of that, 3.5% of the return for international developed, has been due to currency changes. So the weakening of the dollar has been very supportive for international and emerging market equities. And later on, we'll get into some of our manager-specific performance that I want to point out.
You might want to just mention Boston Partners.
Yeah.
They're the manager, the value manager, that's the most underweight U.S. I think they were at 13.5.
They're up 11.8%.
Okay. Yeah. Year-to-date?
Year-to-date.
Wow.
And I'll go through a few more later on. This is an interesting the Atlanta Fed puts together a GDP Now, which is essentially meant to be a forecast of where GDP is going. It, instead of taking all of the components of GDP that they piece together at the end for the estimate release, they kind of piece it together as data comes in. That took a very sharp drop when data came out on January import exports. There was a massive spike in imports to the U.S. Part of that is people trying to get ahead of tariffs. So there was a significant increase in flows in from Canada and Mexico as businesses with supply chain risks in those areas wanted to make sure they had enough inventory on hand. And then there was also a very significant spike in gold imports from Switzerland. That was about $18 billion in a single month. To give some context, that's around the same amount of gold that was imported over the entirety of the prior year. So there's a very large spike. Traders were trying to get their hands on gold and get it to the U.S. As economic uncertainty has kind of spiked. One thing I will say about this is that the predictive value of the exact number is not very high, but directionally in magnitude, it can be fairly accurate. So that significant drop, and you see the kind of range in the blue band there, that's what economic forecasters are kind of predicting. That started to drop, and you've seen more dispersion in what they're expecting. I think it's important to note that this is still an estimate. GDP may not be negative, but it is important to keep an eye on. Looking at the 3 years, so we've talked a lot about year-to-date movements in the market. I think this kind of puts it in context of the bigger picture. U.S. markets are still outperforming significantly, led by tech stocks and the Mag 7. I think that it's important to note EM equity has still had only a marginally positive performance over this time period, annualized return of 80 basis points. But some of the rotation we're seeing today is illustrative of why there's roles for these different components within the portfolio. So here I do want to call out some. These are as of February 28th. There's some of these that have seen some pretty significant moves, as most of the movement is taking place really in March. So as Ryan mentioned, Boston Partners, which was up 8.4% at the end of February, is now up 11.8%. WCM, which was up 3% through the end of February, and that's for one of our most growthy managers, they're now down only 25 basis points, but there's been more rotation. And I did want to mention Walter Scott. It's a growthier manager. I think their performance year-to-date is in line with many of their peers, but they've been hit by some various stock-specific shocks. They had a large position in a company called AppLovin. There's some short seller reports that came out on that that heavily impacted their performance. It's displayed here. On the fixed income side, providing a bit of ballast to the portfolio compared to equities, up 1.5% year-to-date through the end of February, and then the credit portfolio up 1.8% year-to-date. through the end of February.
I would just note, this is the first month that we're showing the breakout under the new asset allocation with fixed income and cash, public credit, and then all of public equity combined.
Another thing to note, earlier in the presentation when we have kind of that public portfolio return, that used to be exclusive of cash. That's now inclusive of cash. So it's just a slightly different number we're looking at there. So all of this through end of February leads to a preliminary year-to-date return for the total portfolio of 2%. I'd say that that's fairly compared to peers and compared to most of the benchmarks we're looking at with our allocation. That's a pretty strong start to the year. Benefit outflow coverage, as Ryan mentioned, there haven't been any significant inflows year to date, so no real changes to this chart from what we've seen in the last couple of months. And then our safety reserve is closely in line with target. One thing that we are watching with our portfolio, and I'll get to this here, most things are pretty close in line, and everything is within the bands that we discussed in our asset class structures. But we are keeping a close eye on this, and towards the end of the month, we're going to take a really close look and see if there's anywhere that we should be looking to rebalance where there's been a lot of strength, maybe into areas of weakness. And finally, our asset allocation as of the end of February. Any questions?
When you're talking about the rebalancing, you're talking about the expensive and that from the safety reserve?
Not so much. I think that the safety reserve is fairly in line. But
28 months is pretty long.
Pretty extensive.
Yeah.
I think, and Ryan, you can comment on this.
Yeah, I mean, it's in line with the 9% target, but obviously we talked about it last month. The time period we have in there is much longer than it was before, given the, you know, gone from close to $10 billion a month to current levels that I think are, you know.
Okay, so that just because we read the way we are now classifying.
No, it's the actual, like, net outflows have decreased the last, you know, with the new funding levels coming in and funding under even the city's ADC. So that gap that was $9, $10 million a month.
It's like six and a half.
So that's what I'm saying. It's overrepresenting that the
yeah.
monies we're getting in before we put them to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And, you know, we'll look at equity and we have a little bit more flexibility if we want to kind of pull that cash down to rebalance elsewhere. But we'll take a look at that. And then we talked about last month, you know, once we get a little bit more certainty on funding, that's probably something that maybe we open back up and look at longer term what to do with that 9% allocation.
Is there some kind of metric for the safety reserve in terms of what it, you know, kind of should be in a normalized way?
I mean,
15 months, 18 months.
I still go back to
our investment policy has it, doesn't it?
What's that?
It's not written in our investment policy about, like, I thought there was like certain, like 15 or something.
It was 18 months.
18 months.
We changed some of that language when we reopened the investment policy in November. I still go back to, we still have maybe on the low level or average levels of cash investment grade bonds. It's only 13% overall. You just have more in cash and more in short term. But I think if we made a tweak, it wouldn't be like, okay, well, we can take all this cash and put it into equities. It would probably be, you know, rearranging how we're allocating across investment grade fixed income and how much we have in cash, given the lower levels of outflow.
I have requested, like, the IAC to just contemplate for you guys to decide what you want to do. But, you know, I did listen what Commerce Street had to say, and I did think one, you know, reasonable comment was the global versus the S&P. You know, and just in terms of analysts, we and our team, we really listened a lot to Dave Zervos. He's just excellent and spot on, and, you know, his view is that, you know, lopsided bad news, you know, relative to good news, and so we're pretty bullish on, you know, as the year goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Would it make sense, and maybe, and once again, it has to fit within the IAC and your guidelines, to look at some of that 400 in the index and maybe put some of it in an S&P index? And
we did talk about that, actually.
Okay. Well,
we did talk about that.
Yeah, just that whenever you guys meet next, I would consider that.
I brought it up, actually. And
if you're, you know, if we're 5, 6, 7% ahead on the one, it may be a good time to use those dollars to buy the, you know, use a dollar, $5 to buy a 95-cent dollar sort of thing.
Ryan, I think I brought that up, and then you said that, no, we do have an index option, but it's a global one, correct?
Yeah, I mean, our index right now is indexed on what's ACWI IMI.
Right, that's ACWI.
Talk about it kind of high level at the February IAC of kind of what other options could be there.
I was talking about that exact idea.
Well, I would just ask you guys would consider it. And,
yeah.
Your guys' domain to propose it, and I don't know if it fits in the guidelines, but I just would proffer that up as a request.
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we talked about is just maybe decomposing the index fund and having sector indexes, which would allow us to pull the lever a bit more between geographies.
We don't want too many levers, but
there's only three of them.
One or two more.
Oh, yeah. But we'll kind of bring that back to the IFC.
I agree with that.
All right. Aaron, you want to go through the...
Yeah, I'd love Aaron. I say that for you. I'd love you to comment on that as well.
Sure. I'll weave it into my comments. And Ryan and Kyle did a great job of the current market, so I'm not going to repeat everything they said. So to start, I'll give you my two cents on the discussion earlier today. So, and I have the privilege or misfortune of attending probably 50 or 60 board meetings or investment meetings a year. And I recognize you guys all attend and sit on probably other boards. But from my shoes, comparing the level of conversation that is conducted here, the lack of emotion, despite pretty heated topics, you guys are definitely running a well-oiled machine. You've been dealt the hard deck of cards, and it's not an instantaneous fix. So I also sit on a pension board in my city. Still waiting for someone to say thank you or appreciate your work. So I'm sure you guys are feeling that even worse, given the spotlight here. So thank you, and I think you're doing a good job.
Thank you. Oh, that's reassuring.
So layering on the brown nosing, I'm going to use a comment Nick said at the beginning of the meeting. And I think a simple way of looking at this program on a high level is, what did the board inherit? And I'm paraphrasing. What has the board done, and what's the plan going forward? So I'm going to try to paint that picture by bouncing around the slides a bit here. So what did the board inherit? Look to this chart on the left. This is your current exposure, broken down by blue are daily liquid products like stocks and bonds. The pink is e-liquid, and the green is monthly. This board inherited a portfolio that looked nothing like that. The pink was over 50% in illiquid assets. And illiquid doesn't connotate bad, but getting liquidity out of illiquid assets is no easy feat. And so bringing this number down so much that the left chart is finally starting to look like the right chart, which has really never happened in 5-6 years, is commendable. You can see that here as well. So what has the board done? You look back, this 2019, this starts. It looked even more pronounced if you go back to 2017. So the blue, public equity, has only grown from the last 5 years. That's been the best place to be in the market. The orange, real estate, real assets, has shrunk. That's been the worst place to be. So the board has been ahead of what has worked in terms of kind of positioning the portfolio. You know, it is gradual and it's challenging, but the decisions that have been made have been the correct decisions. So how has that helped, or what has that meant for results? You look at just calendar year last year, you see a mix of green and red. There were times when it was almost all red. Last year was a year of diversification did not help. It was all about S&P 500 or nothing. Your portfolio produced an 8% return, not terrible, not amazing relative to the S&P, but you look at what a peer healthy plan that didn't have the same challenges produced a return of 9%. So you're right there. The issue is often not this, you know, calendar year by calendar year performance, it's the legacy effect of things compounding and compounding. So you've been able to liquidate or reduce the exposure to a lot of the private market asset classes. And most of the time, staff and Makita has been spent on the public portfolio. And so we look at how has the public portfolio done. So this is looking at global equity. And this is all kind of global equity strategies from eVestment, you know, the popular database. And then it plots your global equity program in the blue square and the ACWI IMI in the green square. So you can see over all these periods, and if you look to the numbers on the bottom, the parentheses show the ranking. Consistently, your program is ranking above median and generally in the top third. So you see those 36, 37, 41, 40. So the program, the four global managers are not all going to all be working well at the same time. And we, you mean the last 2024 versus the last 2.5 months is perfect case study, like Kyle mentioned. Who was on top of four is at bottom. Who was on the bottom of four goes to the top. It's all about the construction. The IEC has spent a lot of time on that, staff and Makita as well. So it's encouraging to see that the areas that you can control are producing. If you look at fixed income, it's a similar story. So this is looking at, you know, fixed income is a bit, there's broader flavors within it, but you can see the green is well in that top quartile or top third, the relative to kind of the broad universe of fixed income strategies. And so the safety reserve has had an unintended benefit by being more in cash and more in short duration securities, as we've had this environment where the short end of the curve went up. So it was put in place for liquidity to pay benefits, you know, full stop. But that has been the area of the market that has been the best place to be in fixed income. That and credit, so your high yield strategies, bank loans, and those have done well. So you missed that middle part of the curve a bit, the core ag type strategies, which has been a drag for most public pension plans. So it shows, again, through good manager selection, some thoughtful design, and some, frankly, some good timing and luck, that the fixed income portfolio is doing quite well. So then what's the plan going forward? I think it's no surprise, markets, the word is uncertain these days. A good case study is, I think, like, you know, the stock market is a leading indicator. It kind of moves on prediction. And then when the event actually happens, it doesn't usually move. What we saw a couple weeks ago when the day that the tariffs actually started, nothing should have happened. The markets already knew it was going to happen, the tariffs were going in. But the fact that markets moved so much that day is kind of an indication that people are not, have no clue what's going to happen with Washington. The fact that, like, I think the markets didn't think that tariffs would actually occur. So it's really impossible to try to gauge and guess and time the market. And so we advocate, as do most pension plans, you have a well thought out governance structure in the IPS, or it's based on the asset allocation. And this, the IEC spent a lot of time there last year. You have your new asset allocation memorialized in place in your IPS now. Then you go down a layer to your asset class structure targets. We went through that exercise in February and January. And then you implement with good manager selection. And staff is on top of that, and Makita, and evaluate. You know, they're not always going to all be performing at the right time, but you have position players. WCM and Boston Partners are the perfect case study there. They play different roles. So I think it's a matter of you continue to just let the investment program do its thing. It's going to, you're getting closer and closer to peers and to benchmarks by each year as the legacy stuff rolls off. But that is, you know, the wounds from those bad investments take a long, long time to truly roll off the trailing returns. That's just a hurdle that anytime a politician is looking at your trailing returns, it's unavoidable. It's there. It's about kind of changing the narrative to looking forward and talking about how the portfolio is positioned now, which is all that this board can control and all that they can, you know, plan for.
Do you think we still have the right managers in the particular asset classes?
Yeah, I mean, there's some of the newer ones, you know, that haven't started as great as we expect. But when there are issues with like a firm turnover or people turnover, we'll address them. And we support the inclusion of the new multi-asset credit manager. With Thalborn adding some private debt, that makes a lot of sense as well. So,
we're happy. What this board, you know, this new governance structure has done, 12 out of 13 public strategies are new since 2017. So we've, you know, not only kind of turned over a lot on the private side, but the entire roster of managers, you know, outside of Walter Scott, everything is 2017 or newer.
One other thing, too, is that, you know, what we didn't do, which is PR-wise hurting us, but I still think it was the right decision, is that we could have come in 2017 and basically done what they call a good bank, bad bank strategy. Mm-hmm. And we could have said that at the time, what was the rough value of all the privates then?
It's $1.6 billion.
We could have said it's worth $200 million. And created a denominator and, you know, used, you know, very aggressively conservative, you know, numbers, and then measured investment results from that, taken the hit at that time. And I, you know, once again, I'm maybe taking some liberties on you know, what accountants or actuaries would let us do, but we could have framed it that way and said that that's how we're going to do it, and then we would have these great investment returns every year and be pat ourselves in the back. But, you know, the funded holes and all that would have been much more significant. Or what we could have done is we could have found some third party that said, take it all off our hands. This is beyond our zone of competence, and, you know, we're not in the business of managing these distressed illiquid assets. It's an inappropriate activity for a pension fund. Give us 15 cents on the dollar, and we would feel, you know, and that would have been, say, $200 million or something like that, you know, at the time. And, you know, we would once again be saying, you know, man, our returns are, you know, top tier, and, you know, it's a clean slate and all that. We didn't do that. What we did is we engaged in what I've called the salvage operation, and it means that there's value to extract. But the value that gets extracted looks horrible measured on a rate of return standpoint. But it did generate cash well in excess of any expectation. And due to the demographic issue we have in terms of the number of people taking benefits from the system relative to people putting money into the system, it's funded that shortfall, which really, you know, when you look at this number of funded ratio where we started in 2017, it was in the
45.
Yeah, and it's in the low 30s now, that, you know, a big piece of that is demographics, okay? And the demographics fall right to the feet of the city, which is, why didn't you recruit more officers? Why didn't you retain more officers? If you had done your job of retaining
and recruiting, this number would be a lot better. And so we'll own what we need to own. It's hard to defend just in a PR soundbite.
Mm-hmm.
You have my attention for 3 seconds, you know, and I already have my view locked in firma bond cement. It's hard to defend what we've done, but I really can't think that you know, we all collectively, staff first and foremost, we make good decisions given the realities of the situation. And, you know, like I said, I go back to this thing on the S&P, and because I think that's a very fair comment on the margin. I don't, you know, what difference would it make, you know, some. I think it's a fair comment. The rest of them, you know, of we should have been more private. I mean, that's in the context of where we're, that's ridiculous. It's fantasy world. Now, going forward, we can consider it. I know we're going to talk about that now. But that's the kind of stuff where our story is very difficult to condense into a very quick soundbite that denotes, like, oh my gosh, those guys just nailed it. Like, I can't sit there and show up and have 5 Super Bowl rings in my hand and just show that and say, yeah, I'm that good. And that because of the complexity from a PR standpoint, which is reality in the case of what happened yesterday, we're pretty vulnerable because ours is a tough one to explain. But I cannot tell you how good I feel about the decisions that we've all made. And, you know, we just should all be mindful of that and appreciate your comments. We thought it was close to brown nosing, not quite. The border brown nosing, but not quite. So we appreciate it.
I think this needs to be said because we've heard it from Dory Wiley and we heard it from yesterday the Senate. The easiest thing to do would be to liquidate, take the $200 million, take the pennies on the dollar. You're adding, they kept saying, well, the city's going to pay in $10, $11 billion. Well, you have another billion or two to add onto that liability. If we had taken that, instead, you went the hard road. You got $1.1 billion out of the private to make up for the pay the shortfall, $1.1 billion. They wouldn't have been there if we'd gone that way. But, hey, our investment returns would look great on paper, and we could all, you know, high-five each other and bring in 15% because, you know, we don't have those legacy assets there. But you were able to – the people in this room were able to fight, you know, scratch and claw to get $1.1 billion out of that, lower the liability for the city going forward. And you're going to thank you for that. I don't know if people are going to understand that, but that's what the reality. You took the hard road, and because of that, this pension and the city are in a better place because of it overall. And that needs to be said, because the easiest thing to do would be to liquidate, pay it off, and then we get to look great going forward. You took the hard road, and you're getting kind of kicked in the teeth left, right, and center because of that. But it was the right thing to do. You did the right thing, Mark.
Well, I mean, you was us. We did. But the only thanks that and just me speaking, the only thanks I want is let us do our job. Yeah. Like I don't want anyone to thank. I just want to be able to
free. I'm good.
I just want to be able to do our job. I want to live within 3158, provided the roadmap for us to do our job. And I just hope that we're still able to do that. And if we can't, then that is a real, you know, I think tragedy if somehow that gets impaired.
It's just it's to your point about saying clever sound bites and responding. It just goes back to two like overall sweeping ideas is that we have to constantly defend this performance, okay? And that it's easy for them to say, well, you've done a bad job. You've done a bad job. And then we have to explain the whole private equity component of it to people. It's easy if you're doing stocks and bonds or public, but when you start talking about private, you know, investments where you have no control, where you're just an LP of a GP, it's lost on them. And it is lost on the bigger population about what complex instruments we were invested in and how difficult and how long it takes to get out of them. And it's just this constant, like, discussion of an education that people don't want to have.
Yeah, and the accountable, I mean, the only accountable party I'm aware of is no one in this room is the city. The city's the one that over an extended period of time allowed this chaos to manifest itself. They're responsible for this track record. And
that somehow...
And they share in it, yes, 100%.
That somehow gets lost. And but once again, we shouldn't sit here and say, like, oh, woe is me. We just need to accept that as that's the PR reality of the situation, and we need to act accordingly.
The frustration to me is it's obvious the backroom politics overshadowed the facts being understood and presented. And to me, that's, you
know, politics.
That's the most disappointing of it all.
Yeah.
And somehow that continues with Senate and
now the House. City. Yeah.
On the fire sale point, this analysis is a little bit dated, but if we would have sold what we had in 2016 for 20 cents on the dollar, we'd have less than $500 million, and the funding rate would be 11%. And I don't think we could have gotten, you know, 20 cents on the dollar for, you know.
I think those numbers are important, though. Those numbers are very important because, you
but
know.
But nobody hears them.
They blame Kelly for it all. Like, somehow her twin was running the pension.
I mean, that's the thing where the facts never get fully presented, and it's just all this other nonsense.
Yeah, it's bad.
They want the facts to get away of the story.
Yeah. But it's a dangerous one because, you know, to your point, they're putting in the structure that they potentially can put in the structure that perpetuates the bad behavior from before.
Yeah, and once again, I don't want to be big picture. One thing, think about that lawsuit and the timeliness of that. And, Josh says, reminds us, we need to get city council approval of that. And these guys are sitting here going, we want to close the deal tomorrow. We want to close the deal tomorrow. How is that ever going to work?
How about the fact that we are all, in some way, shape, or form, financial professionals, and on the council, there is no more financial professional there? That's a bigger problem for me because we're going to have to ask permission from people who do not have the acumen, the financial acumen, are not required by a legislature that says we have to have some level of, you know, financial acumen to be here, not them, but yet we have to go to them, potentially.
Well, and the council is likely to change.
Yes.
The members there. And we don't know who.
So that's, it's just insanity. But anyway, all right. So.
Okay. All right.
So
next.
I have the Q3 private markets performance report. This is the first produced all board report.
Thank you.
So I'll just run through some key areas of this report where you can find some information. Obviously, this is all assets that occurred before all board came on board. We'll have some new investments working in here. And one thing we're going to be very clear to do is to kind of private equity. We'll have new private equity legacy as two separate lines so we can see a clear track record of the new investments we made. So I'll start on 128 of Diligent. One too far. So the big change between this report and what we had from Akita is the performance history here includes all the private market investments that are included in the history, which is not everything, but everything we had in the portfolio kind of circa 2014. So there are 66 different investments that are included in the performance tracker here. I would say limitation a little bit of the Makita report was once we sold something, it dropped out of the history, so we have a more complete picture of the entire private markets portfolio and the performance, good or bad. So the total program performance of what we had is IRR is 1.2%. You can see that. There's an email if you think here. Right there. From here, I will move ahead. So this is looking at the entire portfolio, the three-year track record, and this relates to some valuation changes on the private equity side. But the IRR of the private markets portfolio over 3 years is 9.1%. That's actually exceeding the composite benchmark, which is the underlying asset class target for each, you know, private equity, private credit, real estate, natural resources, and the benchmark for each of those. So some interesting charts that are new to this report. You can see commitments by year up there on the top left. Obviously, a lot of that, if you kind of went back a couple more years, 2016 and prior, 2005, 2006, had a ton of commitments per year in each one of those. We have a value bridge chart looking at the last 12 months at the top. So going back to 9/30 of 23, we had $515 million in private market assets. We had $76 million in sales. And we ended Q3 with $436 million in private market assets. Next page I'll jump to, just going to that point on the 2005 to 2008-ish commitment. Apologize, it's a little bit small, but, and we're on 133 of diligence. But if you just look at the number of commitments per year, 2006, 14, 2007, 12, 2008, 11, and then the amount of money going in each of those years was not vintage year diversification.
What were you thinking?
Yeah.
Shopping?
Nick. Kelly Twin.
Oh, my God.
Kelly
Twin.
Kelly Twin.
You're thinking about that trip to those Italian vineyards.
Yeah. So this is looking at current exposure now. You can see over 90% of what's left in the private markets portfolio is North American, U.S.-based, a little bit in Asia with the TRG, Asian Infrastructure Funds, and the other is the South African timber in the portfolio. Then we get to here, this is looking at individual fund performance. So it's coded by kind of peer group comparison. Orange is the fourth quartile, yellow is the third quartile, light green is second quartile, and dark green is first quartile. What we've done in this public version of the report, we've consolidated real estate into one line item, and same thing on natural resources. We hope next quarter we'll have kind of a closed session version that has the breakout down, but just this being the first report, we're working on a few different formats and getting all the information we want in here. And the last page I wanted to show, jump ahead to 142. And this is...
Hey, Ryan, just to clarify, on page 133 or 11, so the last commitment we made was 2013?
No, it actually goes to the next page.
Okay.
Yeah, so the last two commitments we made was Industry Ventures and Riverstone Credit Partners.
At like $5 million apiece, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was $10 million. Eight to Industry Ventures, $10 to Riverstone. And then just at the bottom of this is looking at kind of what's included in this history. So it's actually 66 funds that have closed, investments that have closed, and 22 current at the bottom. So it's actually 88 investments that are included in the total composite that's showing up in this report now. So I think a lot of good information. Obviously, it becomes more relevant as we add new investments to the portfolio. We'll have Allborn come in, you know, periodically to update this as we get some new investments in the portfolio.
Ryan, the chart that had the exited funds, the IRRs, I don't think are correct. I looked at some of the legacy, that it's of all the terminated funds or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the time value, like look at the Lone Star 3, 2000, those IRRs 31.9.
So what I'm seeing here is we had a 2.1 multiple on that one. We put in 20, we got 40 out. So I guess it depends on the timing of that.
Well, there's no way. I mean, again, I don't know the vintage of 2000, and you're talking about it 2017, third quarter, just a 17-year fund with that kind of, you know, return wouldn't be 31%. So I don't know how they've... When I looked at the footnotes in there, it didn't really...
Yeah, maybe some of these termination dates are not quite right. That one, I would have to look and see if we sold that as part of the secondary sale. It was like a tiny tail piece where, you know, maybe it really liquidated 8 years before and there was 20,000 left and we cleaned it up. So, I would say the onboarding process with Allborn was very comprehensive, where they went back and they say for every fund, including, you know, where they had access to managers on some of these closed funds, they went back and recreated the cash flow history from consultant data, and then where they could, they reconciled it with the manager. So we spent a lot of time kind of going back and forth and, you know, figuring out the right numbers to use. So we'll check a few of those, and just that's the other loan chart. The not Arthur.
I don't think maybe the dates are correct.
Yeah, so I think it may be a date issue, but we'll spot check this, and if there's any other jump out to you, let me know. But
well, I mean, you check them all.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the takeaway. That you know that you're right.
Yeah.
Not my job.
Agreed.
Several just jumped out.
Yeah.
Matt.
And this is organized by commitment date as we go through it. So it's not like real estate versus private equity. It's just by date of initial commitment to the fund.
I like the presentation format here. It's good. So if we get
good data, I mean,
so we need to completely.
It is good data.
We need to get completely confident this is an accurate, reliable source, one that we can all talk from and know that it's valid.
No, and like I said, I would say I was very impressed with Aldmore's process on getting data into their system and not just taking, you know, a trust that we need to have, and not just taking that data, but they were able to validate it against the manager's history as well.
All right.
Any other questions on this report?
Good first start there. All right. And we're moving.